dimension. The net is cast wide over the waters of daily life, but there are also submarines exploring the depths in search of new sources of surplus prized for their rare predictive powers. Your personality, emotions, and endorphins. The examples in these chapters are not intended to be exhaustive, but rather to illustrate the seriousness of purpose, tenacity, and subterfuge with which surveillance capitalists pursue their search for new aspects of human experience that can be monetized as certainty. In this pursuit, we are necessarily involved in citing specific actors, products, and techniques, knowing that the details of persons and companies are constantly churning. Firms will be bought and sold, fail or succeed. People will come and go. Specific technologies, products, and techniques will be abandoned, refined, and surpassed. When they fall, new ones will take their place, as long as surveillance capitalism is allowed to flourish. Velocity and churn have been critical to surveillance capitalism's success, and we cannot allow the constant movement to inhibit our determination to grasp the laws of motion that command this roiling landscape. It is the pattern and its purpose that we want to grasp. 2. Body rendition. The rendition of your body begins quite simply with your phone. Even when your city is not smart or owned and operated by Google, market players with an interest in your behavior know how to find your body. For all of the elaborate ways in which surveillance capitalists labor to render reality as behavior for surplus, the simplest and most profound is their ability to know exactly where you are all the time. Your body is reimagined as a behaving object to be tracked and calculated for indexing and search. Most smartphone apps demand access to your location, even when it's not necessary for the service they provide, simply because the answer to this question is so lucrative. Location data can be extracted from geotags, created when your smartphone automatically embeds your identity and location in photos and videos. Retailers use geofencing to demarcate a geographical area and send alerts to smartphones within those parameters. Come here now, buy this here, an offer just for you. Download the Starbucks app and then leave your house if you want to see this in action. As one marketing consultancy advises, mobile advertising, the ultimate form of geotargeting, is the holy grail of advertising. Tips and tricks for location-based marketing are generously offered by a firm that specializes in mobile advertising. It allows you to tap into people's compulsive nature by encouraging impulse buys with the notifications you send out. It also allows you to gain insight on your current customers by reading what they're saying on Yelp and Facebook. Another mobile marketing firm recommends life pattern marketing based on techniques derived from military intelligence known as patterns of life analysis. These involve gathering location and other data from phones, satellites, vehicles, and sensors to assemble intelligence on the daily behavioral patterns of a person of interest in order to predict future behavior. Marketers are exhorted to map the daily patterns of a target audience in order to intercept people in their daily routines with brand and promotional messages. As the firm emphasizes, the psychological power of the perception of ubiquity is profound. Life pattern marketing forms a powerful psychological imprint on consumers. You can shut down the GPS locator on your phone, but most people do not, both because they rely on its utilities and because they are ignorant of its operations. According to Pew Research, 74% of U.S. smartphone owners in 2003 used apps that required location data, and 90% did so in 2015. That's about 153 million people, more than those who listen to music or watch video on their phones. Surveillance capitalism's reliance on secret operations means that most of us simply do not and cannot know the extent to which our phone doubles as a tracking device for corporate surveillance. A study by researchers at Carnegie Mellon University proves the point efficiently. During a 3-week period, 23 participants were continuously informed of the number of apps accessing their location information and the total number of accesses in a given period. They were flabbergasted by the sheer volume of the onslaught as they each variously learned that their locations were accessed 4,182 times, 5,398 times, 356 times, and so on over a 14-day period, all for the sake of advertisers, insurers, retailers, marketing firms, mortgage companies, and anyone else who pays to play in these behavioral markets. As one participant summed it up, "It felt like I'm being followed by my own phone. It's scary." 58% of participants subsequently restricted the permissions granted to their mobile apps. Unsurprisingly, Google represents the vanguard of location-based tracking. A 2016 affidavit from law enforcement officials seeking a search warrant for a California bank robber made plain why Google location data are unparalleled. Google collects and retains location data from Android-enabled mobile devices. Google collects this data whenever one of their services is activated and/or whenever there is an event on the mobile device, such as a phone call, text messages, internet access, or email access. The officials on the case requested location information from Google because it offers far more detail than even the phone companies can provide. The location systems in Android combine cell tower data with GPS, Wi-Fi networks, and other information culled from photos, videos, and other sources. That lets Android pinpoint users to a single building rather than a city block. In November 2017, Quartz investigative reporters discovered that since early 2017, Android phones had been collecting location information by triangulating the nearest cell towers, even when location services were disabled, no apps were running, and no carrier SIM card was installed in the phone. The information was used to manage Google's push notifications and messages sent to users on their Android phones, enabling the company to track whether an individual with an Android phone or running Google apps had set foot in a specific store, and use that to target the advertising a user subsequently sees. Google's location history system is a product of the corporation's global mapping operations. Though active for over a decade, it was unveiled to the public only in 2015 as Your Timeline, a feature that allows you to visualize your real-world routines. The corporation calculated that any negative reaction to the volume and persistence of tracking revealed by Timeline would be mitigated by the value of users' active contributions to their own stocks of behavioral surplus as they fine-tune the information, add relevant photos, insert comments, and so forth. This was represented as an individual's investment in personalized services such as Google Now, so that it might more effectively comb your email and apps in order to push relevant traffic and weather updates, notifications, suggestions, and reminders. Location data is the quid pro quo for these services. Your transaction is greased by the universal promises of privacy and control. Your timeline is private and visible only to you, and you control the locations you choose to keep. But Google uses your location data to target ads. Indeed, these are among the most significant sources of surplus in Google's advertising markets, with a direct impact on click rates. The standard account from Google and other surveillance capitalists is that behavioral surplus is retained only as metadata, which are then aggregated across large numbers of individual users. We are told that it's not possible to identify individuals from these large-scale amalgamations. However, with as little as 3 bits of data easily culled from the public record, birth date, zip code, and sex, re-identification science has demonstrated its ability to de-anonymize metadata with disturbing ease. In a summary of this research, legal scholar Paul Ohm writes that re-identification makes all our secrets fundamentally easier to discover and reveal. Our enemies will find it easier to connect us to facts that they can use to blackmail, harass, defame, frame, or discriminate against us. This mistake pervades nearly every information privacy law. Regarding the massive caches of supposedly anonymous behavior surplus, Ohm calls them databases of ruin. When it comes to location data, the situation is just as bad. In 2013, a group of MIT and Harvard computer scientists demonstrated that because individuals tend to have idiosyncratic mobility signatures, any analyst with the right tools can easily extract the mobility pattern of a specific individual within a large anonymized data set of location metadata. Another research team demonstrated that data collected by seemingly innocuous smartphone-embedded sensors, such as accelerometers, gyroscopes, and magnetometers, can be used to infer an ever-growing range of human activities and even moods. Their work also shows that these sensor data can be used to obtain sensitive information about specific users from anonymized datasets. Companies are putting these surveillance capabilities to work. Broadcom produced a global navigation satellite system in a chip that combines satellite communications with the sensors in your cell phone to create a positioning engine that can find your location even if you are not connected to a network, including your location in a building, how many steps you've taken, in what direction, at what altitude. All this depends solely on one factor, says a company vice president, the device in your hand. Princeton computer scientists Arvind Narayanan and Edward Felton summed it up this way. There is no known effective method to anonymize location data, and no evidence that it's meaningfully achievable. Even without de-anonymization, location metadata constitute an unrivaled concentration of knowledge within private firms and an extraordinary advantage in the division of learning. In 2016, Chinese search engine Baidu, often referred to as the Google of China, announced that its big data lab uses location data from its 600 million users to track and predict the dynamics of the Chinese economy. The company built an employment index for the national economy, as well as a consumption index. It also touted its ability to generate quite specific predictions, such as Apple's second quarter earnings in China that year. To the best of our knowledge, Baidu researchers wrote, "We are the first to measure the second largest economy by mining such unprecedentedly large-scale and fine granular spatial-temporal data." As powerful as location data are, wearable technologies and their applications are another significant proving ground in the act of body rendition. One 2017 report describes a new generation of wearables armed with more sensors and smarter algorithms focused on biometric monitoring and body parts as conduits for data collection. These complex sensors can access environmental context, smells, emotional state. Google has developed internet-enabled fabrics, claiming that it aims to bring inductive yarns to every garment and fabric on Earth. If you can weave the sensor into the textile, as a material, explains project leader Ivan Puparev, you're moving away from the electronics. You're making the basic materials of the world around us interactive. A partnership with Levi Strauss has already yielded interactive denim, including a jacket first brought to market in September 2017. The material is described as able to infer behavior in order to be interactive yet authentic. The jacket contains sensors that can see through the fabric to detect and decipher gestures as subtle as the twitch of your finger. There is a numbing repetition of McKay's themes throughout the literature on wearables. Just as he insisted that telemetric devices must operate outside the awareness of unrestrained animals, today's developers stress that wearables must be unobtrusive to avoid raising alarm. They are to be continuous, pervasive, and crucially low cost in order to achieve economies of scope. The digital marketing firm Ovum forecasts 650 million wearables by 2020, nearly double the number used in 2016, and its research suggests that growth is largely driven by the lure of surveillance revenues. Mobile advertisers, they report, see wearables as a source of very granular data insights, and also new types of behavioral and usage data. Wearables of the future will have the ability to capture a wide array of data related to users' contextual activity, health, and emotional state. This information can be used to enhance and tailor both products and marketing messages to a very high degree. Healthcare is an especially active proving ground for wearable sensored technologies, a development that's particularly pernicious given the more innocent origins of this idea. When telemetry first shifted from McKay's gaggles, flocks, and herds to the human animal, one of its first applications was as a means to oversee the vulnerable in the form of push-button pendants for elderly people alone in their homes. In 2002, the year that a still-secret surveillance capitalism achieved its first breakthroughs, a review of wireless telemedicine stressed the value of home monitoring for the elderly and for the expansion of health services in remote areas. As in the case of the Aware Home, a diagram of the proposed digital architecture for such home monitoring services features only three parties: a closed loop that exclusively links a patient at home, her hospital's servers, and her physician. There are no extra parties imagined in either of these designs, no companies capturing your behavior, no behemoth tech firms with their porous platforms and proprietary servers transforming your life into surplus so they can make a book on what you will do next and enable their customers to sell it to you first. Before the birth and spread of surveillance capitalism, it was possible to imagine digital representations of your body as an enrichment of the intimate relationships between a patient and a trusted doctor, a mother and her child, elderly parents and their adult children. As surveillance capitalism overwhelms the digital milieu, that vision has been made ridiculous. Both the Aware Home and the telemedicine design assume that all behavioral data are reinvested in service to the human being who is the subject of these arrangements, providing serenity, trust, and dignity, a chance for real knowledge and empowerment. Many articles on health monitoring continue to emphasize its utility for the elderly, but the conversation has decisively moved on from this earlier state of grace. Some researchers anticipate the fusion of smart cities and what's now called mHealth to produce smart health, defined as the provision of health services by using the context-aware network and sensing infrastructure of smart cities. Toward that end, there are now reliable sensors for rendering an increasing range of physiological processes as behavioral data, including body temperature, heart rate, brain activity, muscle motion, blood pressure, sweat rate, energy expenditure, and body and limb motion. There are sensors that can render audio, visual, and physiological data during post-surgical patient recovery and rehabilitation. A flexible, sensored textile patch has been developed that can render breathing, hand movements, swallowing, and walking as behavioral data. In other applications, wearable micro-machined sensors provide accurate biomechanical analysis as you walk or run, and a body area network records and analyzes walking and running under extreme conditions. It is eloquent testimony to the healthcare system's failure to serve the needs of second modernity individuals that we now access health data and advice from our phones, while these pocket computers aggressively access us. mHealth has triggered an explosion of rendition and behavioral surplus capture as individuals turn in record numbers to their fitness bands and diet apps for support and guidance. By 2016, there were more than 100,000 mobile health apps available on the Google Android and Apple iOS platforms, double the number in 2014. These rich data can no longer be imagined as cloistered within the intimate closed loops between a patient and her doctor, or between an application and its dieters or runners. That bucolic vision has its holdouts, to be sure. But for surveillance capitalists, this vision is but a faded daguerreotype. In the U.S., most health and fitness applications are not subject to health privacy laws, and the laws that do exist do not adequately take into account either new digital capabilities or the ferocity of surveillance capitalist operations. Companies are expected to self-regulate by following guidelines suggested by the Federal Trade Commission, FTC, and other government agencies. For example, in 2016, the FTC issued a list of best practices for developers of mobile health applications aimed at increasing transparency, privacy, and security. Among these suggestions, developers are encouraged to make sure your app doesn't access consumer information it doesn't need. Let consumers select particular contacts, rather than having your app request access to all user contacts through the standard API. And let users choose privacy-protective default settings. That year, the Food and Drug Administration announced that it would also not seek to regulate health and fitness apps, citing their low-level risk. Instead, the agency released its own set of voluntary guidelines for software developers. The agency's well-meaning guidelines overlook the inconvenient truth that transparency and privacy represent friction for surveillance capitalists in much the same way that improving working conditions, rejecting child labor, and shortening the workday represented friction for the early industrial capitalists. It took targeted laws to change working conditions back then, not suggestions. Then, as now, the problems to which these pleas for self-restraint are addressed cannot be understood as excesses, mistakes, oversights, or lapses of judgment. They are necessitated by the reigning logic of accumulation and its relentless economic imperatives. A legal review of mobile help apps concludes that most of them take the consumer's private information and data without the consumer's permission, and do not generally disclose to the user that this information will be sent to advertising companies. These conclusions are borne out by a long queue of studies, but let's focus on a 2016 in-depth investigation by scholars from the Monk School of Global Affairs at the University of Toronto in association with Open Effect, a nonprofit focused on digital privacy and security. This study looked at the collection, processing, and usage activities associated with 9 fitness trackers. 7 were chosen for their popularity, 1 was made by a Canadian company, and the 9th was an app that specialized in women's health. All but 2 apps transmitted every logged fitness event to the company's servers, which enabled backup and sharing with one's friends, but also data analytics and distribution to third parties. Some of the trackers transmitted device identification numbers. Others passively and continuously transmitted the user's precise longitude and latitude coordinates. These identifiers could link fitness and biographical data to a single mobile phone hardware or single specific fitness wearable. None of this sensitive information was necessary for the tracker to operate effectively, and most of the privacy policies were opaque at best, and allowed data to be sold or exchanged with third parties. As we know, once a third party captures your surplus, it is shared with other third parties, who share with other third parties, and so on. The team also examined the tracker's transmission of the Bluetooth Media Access Controller, or MAC, address that is unique to each phone. When this address is publicly discoverable, any third party with an interest in your movements, retailers who want to know your mall activity, insurers concerned about your compliance with an exercise regime, can persistently track your phone. Mobile data sets logged over time can be combined to form a fine-grained picture of your movements, enabling targeted applications and heightening the probability of guaranteed outcomes. The only real protection is when an app randomly but regularly generates a new MAC address for your phone. But of the 9 trackers, only Apple's performed this operation. The report also identifies a general pattern of careless security, as well as the ability to generate false data. The researchers observed that consumers are likely to be misled and confused, overestimating the extent of security measures and underestimating the breadth of personal data collected by fitness tracking companies. As they concluded, we discovered severe security vulnerabilities, incredibly sensitive geolocation transmissions that serve no apparent benefit to the end user, and policies leaving the door open for the sale of users' fitness data to third parties without express consent of the users. If you are inclined to dismiss this report because fitness trackers can be written off as toys, let's consider a look at an incisive investigation into Android-based diabetes apps in a 2016 Journal of American Medicine research report, and with it, ample illustration of the frenzy of body rendition. The researchers note that although the FDA approved the prescription of a range of apps that transmit sensitive health data, the behind-the-scenes practices of these apps are understudied. They examined 211 diabetes apps and randomly sampled 65 of them for close analysis of data transmission practices. Among these apps, merely downloading the software automatically authorized collection and modification of sensitive information. The researchers identified a great deal of backstage action, including apps that modify or delete your information, 64%, read your phone status and identity, 31%, gather location data, 27%, view your Wi-Fi connections, 12%, and activate your camera in order to access your photos and videos, 11%. Between 4% and 6% of the apps went even further, reading your contact lists, calling phone numbers found in your device, modifying your contacts, reading your call log, and activating your microphone to record your speech. Finally, the research team unearthed an even darker secret. Privacy policies do not matter. Of the 211 apps in the group, 81% did not have privacy policies. But for those that did, not all of the provisions actually protected privacy. Of those apps without privacy policies, 76% shared sensitive information with third parties. And of those with privacy policies, 79% shared data, while only about half admitted doing so in their published disclosures. In other words, privacy policies are more aptly referred to as surveillance policies, and that is what I suggest we call them. There are many new territories of body rendition. Organs, blood, eyes, brain waves, faces, gait, posture. Each of these expresses the same patterns and purpose that we have seen here. The surveillance capitalists relentlessly fight any attempts to constrain rendition. The ferocity with which they claim their right to rendition out of thin air is ample evidence of its foundational importance in the pursuit of surveillance revenues. This ferocity is well illustrated in surveillance capitalists' determination to discourage, eliminate, or weaken any laws governing the rendition of biometric information, especially facial recognition. Because there is no federal law in the U.S. that regulates facial recognition, these battles occur at the state level. Currently, the Illinois Biometric Privacy Act offers the most comprehensive legal protections, requiring companies to obtain written consent before collecting biometric information from any individual, and, among other stipulations, granting individuals the right to sue a company for unauthorized rendition. The Center for Public Integrity, along with journalists, privacy advocates, and legal scholars, has documented the active opposition of surveillance capitalists to the Illinois law and similar legislative proposals in other states. With its unique competitive advantages in facial recognition, Facebook is considered the most uncompromising of all the tech companies when it comes to biometric data, described as working feverishly to prevent other states from enacting a law like the one in Illinois. Facebook's considerable political muscle had been cultivated in just a few years as it learned to emulate Google's playbook of political and cultural fortifications. The company's founder, Mark Zuckerberg, demonstrated an iron determination to preserve his freedom in lawless space, pushing the boundaries of existing regulations and vigorously opposing even the whisper of new law. Between 2009 and 2017, the company increased its lobbying spending by a factor of 50, building a massive lobbying entourage of Washington power brokers. Facebook's $4.6 million in donations during the 2016 election cycle complemented its lobbying budget of $11.5 million in 2017. Zuckerberg's advantages in biometrics are significant. In 2017, Facebook boasted 2 billion monthly users uploading 350 million photos every day, a supply operation that the corporation's own researchers refer to as practically infinite. In 2018, a Facebook research team announced that it had closed the gap and was now able to recognize faces in the wild with 97.35% accuracy, closely approaching human-level performance. The report highlights the corporation's supply and manufacturing advantages, especially the use of deep learning based on large training sets. Facebook announced its eagerness to use facial recognition as a means to more powerful ad targeting, but even more of the uplift would come from the immense machine training opportunities represented by so many photos. By 2018, its machines were learning to discern activities, interests, mood, gaze, clothing, gait, hair, body type, and posture. The marketing possibilities are infinite. It should not surprise any student of the prediction imperative that with these advantages in hand, Facebook is unwilling to accept anything less than total conquest in its bid to render faces for the sake of more lucrative prediction products. So far, Facebook and its brethren have been successful, turning back legislative proposals in Montana, New Hampshire, Connecticut, and Alaska, and fatally weakening a bill that was passed in Washington state. Among the tech companies, only Facebook continued to oppose even the diminished terms of the Washington legislation. If rendition is interrupted, surveillance capitalism cannot stand, for the whole enterprise rests on this original sin. This fact is amply displayed in the public drama surrounding the ill-fated 2015 attempt to produce public guidelines on the creation and use of biometric information through a voluntary, privacy multi-stakeholder process convened by the National Telecommunications and Information Association, NTIA, under the auspices of the U.S. Department of Commerce. After weeks of negotiations, consumer advocates walked out in protest over the hard-line position of the tech companies and their lobbyists on the single most pivotal issue, consent. The companies insisted on their right to use facial recognition systems to identify a stranger on the street without first obtaining the individual's consent. As one lobbyist in the talks told the press, "Everyone has the right to take a photograph in public. If someone wants to apply facial recognition, should they really need to get consent in advance?" Privacy scholars were quick to respond that there is no lawfully established right to such actions, let alone a First Amendment right. Nobody reckoned with the fact that the prediction imperative makes individual ignorance the preferred condition for rendition operations, just as Arendt had observed and McKay had prescribed for animals in the wild. Original sin prefers the dark. The talks continued without the advocates, and in 2016, the NTIA issued its Privacy Best Practice Recommendations for Commercial Facial Recognition Use. The guidelines should be understood as the best for the surveillance capitalists, but as the worst for everyone else. In the language of these guidelines, the tech companies, retailers, and others determined to chase surveillance revenues are simply encouraged to make their policies on facial recognition available to consumers in a reasonable manner. Where companies impose facial recognition on a physical location, they are encouraged to provide notice to consumers. Rendition operations are tacitly accorded legitimacy, not only in the lack of contest, but because they stand as the immovable facts draped in the cheap garlands of toothless best practices. Georgetown University legal scholar Alvaro Bedoya, a member of the advocacy group that quit the deliberations, blasted the recommendations as a mockery of the fair information practice principles on which they claim to be grounded. They offer no real protection for individuals and cannot be taken seriously. Under the regime of surveillance capitalism, individuals do not render their experience out of choice or obligation, but rather out of ignorance and the dictatorship of no alternatives. The ubiquitous apparatus operates through coercion and stealth. Our advance into life necessarily takes us through the digital, where involuntary rendition has become an inescapable fact. We are left with few rights to know, or to decide who knows, or to decide who decides. This abnormal division of learning is created and sustained by secret fiat, implemented by invisible methods, and directed by companies bent to the economic imperatives of a strange new market form. Surveillance capitalists impose their will backstage, while the actors perform the stylized lullabies of disclosure and agreement for the public. The prediction imperative transforms the things that we have into things that have us, in order that it might render the range and richness of our world, our homes, and our bodies as behaving objects for its calculations and fabrications on the path to profit. The chronicles of rendition do not end here, however. Act 2 requires a journey from our living rooms and streets to another world below the surface, where inner life unfolds. Chapter 9. Rendition from the Depths. I couldn't feel, so I tried to touch. Leonard Cohen. Hallelujah. 1. Personalization as Conquest. Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella introduced Cortana, the corporation's personal digital assistant, at the firm's annual Ignite conference in 2016. He said, "This new category of the personal digital assistant is a runtime, a new interface. It can take text input, it can take speech input, it knows you deeply. It knows your context, your family, your work. It knows the world. It is unbounded. In other words, it's about you, it's not about any one device. It goes wherever you go, it's available on any phone, iOS, Android, Windows, doesn't matter. It is available across all of the applications that you will use in your life." This is a new frontier of behavioral surplus, where the dark data continent of your inner life, your intentions and motives, meanings and needs, preferences and desires, moods and emotions, personality and disposition, truth-telling or deceit, is summoned into the light for others' profit. The point is not to cure, but to render all of it as immeasurably tiny bits of behavior available for calculation, so that each can take its place on the assembly line that moves from raw materials to product development, manufacturing, and sales. The machine invasion of human depth is prosecuted under the banner of personalization, a slogan that betrays the zest and cynicism brought to the grimy challenge of exploiting second modernity needs and insecurities for outsized gain. From the point of view of the prediction imperative, personalization is a means of individualizing supply operations in order to secure a continuous flow of behavioral surplus from the depths. This process can be accomplished successfully only in the presence of our unrelenting hunger for recognition, appreciation, and most of all, support. Recall that Hal Varian, Google's chief economist, helped chart this course. Personalization and customization are the third new use of computer-mediated transactions. Instead of having to ask Google questions, it should know what you want and tell you before you ask the question. Google Now, the corporation's first digital assistant, was charged with this task. Varian warned that people would have to give Google even more of themselves in order to reap the value of the application. Google now has to know a lot about you and your environment to provide these services. This worries some people. He rationalizes any concern, arguing that rendering personal information to Google is no different from sharing intimacies with doctors, lawyers, and accountants. "Why am I willing to share all this private information?" he asks. "Because I get something in return. These digital assistants will be so useful that everyone will want one." Varian is confident that the needs of second modernity individuals will subvert any resistance to the rendition of personal experience as the quid pro quo for the promise of a less stressful and more effective life. In fact, Varian's notion of personalization is the precise opposite of the relationships with trusted professionals to which he refers. Doctors, accountants, and attorneys are held to account by mutual dependencies and reciprocities dictated by the extensive institutionalization of professional education, codes of conduct, and procedures for evaluation and review. Violation of these rules risks punishment in the form of professional sanction and public law. Google and its brethren in surveillance capitalism bear no such risks. Varian's remarks constitute one of those rare occasions in which the fog of technology rhetoric parts just enough to discern the utilities of social and economic inequality to surveillance capitalism's larger mission. Varian reasons that inequality offers an opportunity to raise the ante on Google's quid pro quo for effective life. He counsels that the way to predict the future is to observe what rich people have, because that's also what the middle class and the poor will want. "What do rich people have now?" he asks rhetorically. "Personal assistants." That the luxuries of one generation or class become the necessities of the next has been fundamental to the evolution of capitalism during the last 500 years. Historians describe the consumer boom that ignited the first industrial revolution in late 18th century Britain, when, thanks to visionaries like Josiah Wedgwood and the innovations of the early modern factory, families new to the middle class began to buy the china, furniture, and textiles that only the rich had previously enjoyed. This new propensity to consume is considered unprecedented in the depth to which it penetrated the lower reaches of society. In 1767, the political economist Nathaniel Forster worried that fashionable luxury was spreading like a contagion, and he complained of the perpetual restless ambition in each of the inferior ranks to raise themselves to the level of those immediately above them. Adam Smith wrote insightfully on this social process, noting that upper-class luxuries can in time be recast as necessaries. This occurs as the established rules of decency change to reflect new customs introduced by elites, triggering lower-cost production methods that transform what was once unattainable into newly affordable goods and services. Ford's Model T is the outstanding 20th century example of this progression. Varian casts personalization as a 21st century equivalent of these historical dynamics, the new necessaries for the harried masses bent under the weight of stagnant wages, dual career obligations, indifferent corporations, and austerity's hollowed-out public institutions. Varian's bet is that the digital assistant will be so vital a resource in the struggle for effective life that ordinary people will accede to its substantial forfeitures. "There is no putting the genie back in the bottle," Varian, the inevitabilist, insists. "Everyone will expect to be tracked and monitored, since the advantages, in terms of convenience, safety, and services, will be so great, continuous monitoring will be the norm." Everyone, that is, except those wealthy or stubborn enough to achieve effective life without Google's assistance, and thus escape the worst excesses of rendition. As decision rights and self-determination become privileges of the wealthy, what will Varian offer to answer those who clamor for the same? Historically, breakthroughs in lower-cost goods and services unleashed expansions of production and employment, higher wages, and an improved standard of living for many. Varian has no such reciprocities in mind. Instead, he pokes his finger into the open wound of second modernity insecurities and bends our pain to the objectives of the surveillance project. With Varian, the hunger for new necessities is construed as an opportunity to dispossess, even as it conveniently provides the justification for that dispossession right down to the depths. Google Now was a first step, although later it would look more like a stalking horse and habituation exercise, paving the way for what was to come. Christened Predictive Search, it combined every system that Google had ever built, including the corporation's achievements in voice search and neural networking. Its knowledge of the world, represented in its 1 billion entity knowledge graph, and its unparalleled machine intelligence capabilities. All of this firepower was amassed in order to learn from your content, context, and behavior, not only through search, email, and calendar activity, but also from the data in your phone, including movement, location, activities, voice, and apps. This time, the aim was not only to sell ads, but rather to guess the information you'll need at any given moment as you move through the real world. As a promotional video crows, Google Now is always one step ahead so you can feel more confident as you navigate your day. With the predictive power of Now, you get just what you need to know right when you need it. One writer described the new service as having the search engine come to you. The app's information cards swim into view on your phone's home screen in anticipation of your needs. Notification of a changed flight time, impending weather and traffic, nearby restaurants and shops, that museum you've been wanting to visit. One Google executive reasoned that Google already knows all of this about you, so it might as well turn it into a service that can provide the company with access to even more information. Google's going to know when my flight is, whether my package has gotten here yet, and where my wife is, and how long it's going to take her to get home this afternoon. Of course Google knows that stuff. Google Now's predictive capabilities follow the pattern we have seen throughout. They derive from machine processes trained on unceasing flows of virtual and real-world behavior. Why did Google devote so much machine power and valuable surplus in order to thoroughly assist you through your day? The reason is that Google Now signaled a new breed of prediction products. Google's breakthrough crawler enabled the lightning-fast indexing of the World Wide Web. The apparatus of ubiquity then enabled new operations to crawl reality. And now, in this third phase, distinct supply operations are required to crawl our lives. In Google Now, one sees an initial foray into this new space, in which the web crawler's ability to find information combines with new life-crawling operations intended to render, anticipate, and, as we shall see, ultimately modify your behavior. Online and offline behavioral surplus, your email content, where you went this afternoon, what you said, what you did, how you felt, are combined into prediction products that can serve an emerging marketplace in which every aspect of your daily reality is up for bid. Facebook's M, launched in 2015 as part of its Messenger application, is another example of this new phase. It was introduced as a personal digital assistant that completes tasks and finds information on your behalf, powered by artificial intelligence that's trained and supervised by people. Facebook's vice president in charge of messaging products described the company's goals for M by saying, "We start capturing all of your intent from the things you want to do. Intent often leads to buying something or to a transaction, and that's an opportunity for us to make money over time." Most importantly, the VP stressed, M learns from human behaviors. The corporation's machines would be trained on surplus from Messenger's 700 million daily users. Eventually, it was hoped, M's operations would be fully automated and would not need human trainers. By 2017, Facebook had scaled back its machine intelligence ambitions and focused its personal assistant on the core mission, commerce. The team in there now is finding ways to activate commercial intent inside Messenger, a Facebook executive reported. The idea is to prioritize commerce-driven experiences and design new ways for users to quickly buy things without the tedium of entering credit card information, flipping pages, or opening applications. Pop-up buttons appear during your conversations with friends whenever the system detects a possible commercial intention. Just tap to order, buy, or book, and let the system do the rest. In this way, the personal digital assistant is revealed as a market avatar, another Trojan horse in which the determination to render and monetize your life is secreted under the veil of assistance and embellished with the poetry of personalization. Its friendly recommendations, advice, and eagerness to act on your behalf barely conceal an aggressive new market cosmos hovering over any and every aspect of your daily life. It may be composed of restaurants, banks, plumbers, merchants, ticket sellers, airlines, and a limitless queue of possible strangers summoned by their interests in your behavior, now, soon, and later. They are standing by to cash in on your walk to work, your conversation with your teenager, or your aging running shoes. A digital assistant may derive its character from your inclinations and preferences, but it will be skewed and disfigured in unknown measure by the hidden market methods and contests that it conceals. Google joined other tech companies determined to establish conversation as the medium through which humans engage with the apparatus. In time, the obsession with voice may be surpassed or joined by others, so that merely thinking a thought or waving a finger can translate into and initiate action. For now, there are compelling reasons for the race to the spoken word. The first is obvious. Reliable voice recognition can translate a sprawling landscape of service interactions into low-cost, automated processes of theoretically unlimited scale and scope, a fact that has been noted by labor economists for some time. The competitive race between a new crop of personal digital assistants is best understood from this point of view. The voice that rises to dominance, the one voice, will be the colossus of behavioral surplus pipelines with a potentially insurmountable competitive advantage in its ability to corner and kidnap the dominant share of human experience. Conversation stands alone in its promise to dominate raw material supply, and the rewards to the one voice would be astronomical. Casual talk helps to blur the boundaries between it, the apparatus saturated with commercial agents, and us. In conversation, we imagine friendship. The more we fancy the apparatus as our confidant, nanny, governess, and support system, a disembodied, pervasive Mrs. Doubtfire for each person, the more experience we allow it to render, and the richer its supply operations grow. Communication is the first human joy, and a conversational interface is prized for the frictionless ease in which a mere utterance can trigger action, especially market action. Let there be light. Let there be new running shoes. What could be dreamier than to speak and have it be so? An Amazon senior vice president comments on the company's voice-activated home devices. The nice thing about the Amazon device business is that when we sell a device, generally, people buy more blue jeans and little black dresses and shoes, and so that's good. Voice shopping, he concludes, is good for business and good for predicting business. In a conversation addressed to a digital thing, as opposed to a conversation in a shop, words can occur on the fly with less friction and effort, less inhibition, fretting, and comparing, less concern about the limits of one's bank account or where a product or service is sourced, less doubt and hesitation, less memory and remorse. The speaker feels herself at the center of a seamlessly flowing universe. The seams are all backstage, where the machines confront and conquer stubborn sources of friction, such as distinct apps and entities, recalcitrant administrative service, distribution, payments and delivery systems, and boundaries and borders that threaten the flows of desire and satisfaction. Spontaneous and fluid, universally burbling conversation turns the new personal digital assistant into a voice that sits between your life and the new markets for your life, between your experience and the auctioning of your experience. A runtime, a new interface that creates the sensation of mastery while, in fact, giving it away. In this commercial dreamscape, words that were once conceived of as behind closed doors are eagerly rendered a surplus. These new supply operations convert your talk into behavior for surplus in two ways. The first derives from what you say, the second from how you say it. Smart home devices such as Amazon's Echo or Google Home render rivers of casual talk from which sophisticated content analyses produce enhanced predictions that can anticipate your needs. Google used its 2016 Developers Conference to introduce its conversational reimagining of Google Now, rechristened Assistant, and integrated across the company's devices, services, tools, and applications. We want users to have an ongoing, two-way dialogue with Google. We want to help you get things done in your real world, and we want to do it for you, explained Google CEO Sundar Pichai. For example, you can be in front of this structure in Chicago and ask Google, "Who designed this?" You don't need to say the bean or the cloud gate. We understand your context and we answer that the designer is Anish Kapoor. Google's assistant arrived already integrated into Google's new messaging app, Allo, where it can search for information, execute tasks, or even compose routine messages on your behalf. Most importantly, Assistant animates the firm's home device, Google Home. The idea is that in time, the device, or its successor, will claim for rendition a theoretically limitless scope of animate and inanimate domestic activities, conversations, light bulbs, queries, schedules, movement, travel planning, heating systems, purchases, home security, health concerns, music, communication functions, and more. There was a time when you searched Google, but now Google searches you. Advertisements for Google Home feature loving families leading busy, intricate lives, but visibly relieved to return home and fall into the arms of this omniscient, efficient caretaker. This second modernity dream come true extracts an unusually high tax for its promise of a more effective life. For each user to have his or her own individual Google, as Pichai envisions, Google must have each individual. The caretaker's ability to effectively serve you depends entirely upon the degree to which your life is rendered, knowingly or unknowingly, to its ministrations. The breadth and depth of rendered life correspond to the scale of market action that can be triggered and mediated by Assistant. There are differences among the various incarnations of personalization and assistance offered by the tech giants, but these are trivial compared with the collective urge toward total knowledge about your inner states, real-world context, and specific daily life activities, all in the service of successfully training the machines that they might better target market operations to each moment of life. All the potential market action associated with what you say depends upon voice activation, recognition, and response. These, in turn, are the product of highly sophisticated machine systems trained on vast global stockpiles of spoken words. The more structural insights the machines glean from spoken surplus, the more commerce flows from its content. This means that the value of what you say cannot be realized without machines that can learn from precisely how you say it. This form of surplus derives from the structure of your speech: vocabulary, pronunciation, intonation, cadence, inflection, dialect. The competition for supplies of talk turns your phrases into this second form of surplus as companies determine to develop and perfect voice capabilities, scour the world for speech. Amazon.